It's such a joy to be doing this with Steve, and just the opportunity to share the Dharma really forces one to ask, well, what do I know about this? So I get to tell you kind of like how I've been practicing with it. And Steve did such a lovely job this morning. And like all the teachings, we are encouraged to see for ourselves. Ahipasiko, come and see for yourself. We come and see whether these words about anicca and anatta make sense for us, and how do we experience them. And so I'm going to be sharing some of the ways that I've experienced it, some of those doorways that both Steve and I have talked about. And there are many doorways, and these are just some of what's worked for me. And I'm going to talk a little bit about dukkha as well, even though this is only a day on anicca and anatta, because how I changed my relationship with dukkha helped inform how I changed my relationship to impermanence and not self. So I was first introduced to the Dharma at a 10-day retreat on death and dying with Stephen Levine. My older sister, Nancy, had just died a few weeks before. She was my best friend, my advisor, mentor, advocate, and co-conspirator in the family, as we would do things that sisters did. We were really close, and I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I had read Stephen's book, Who Dies, which is a wonderful book if you've never read it. But the main thing that struck me when I was on this retreat and started learning about Buddhism and the teachings was his emphasis on being with what is, his emphasis on the truth. Right now, right here, being with the way things are. And it can be hard to be with the truth. Sometimes what we see isn't what we want to see. We argue with it. We believe that we can make things different. And sometimes what the mind says is true isn't really true. It's just a collection of old beliefs or emotional habits. And so we practice. How beautiful that is, that we practice. We watch the mind as it sometimes distorts and fabricates, makes up things, tells stories. And while we're doing this, we can cultivate this honesty, this inner honesty. We question the truth of the thoughts. And the longer we practice, the more we understand the answer to what's the truth of this moment. And of course, one of the truths is that anything can happen at any time. My father died when I was very young. I didn't really know him, so I hadn't really absorbed what death meant. Then my grandfather died when I was 12, and he lived with us, and he was a pretty important part of my life, but he was 90 when he died. So again, it didn't really hit me. But when my sister Nancy died, she was 44, it was real. It was painful. And it was really a gift that my first introduction to the Dharma was through death. There's no way to avoid the truth that someone who is so important to me, who the stories in the family are that she kind of took, she's 6 years older, and she took me, she decided that she would be more mother to me when I was born. So somebody who knew me my entire life was then gone. Being up close and personal with death has really been a guide for me in understanding the truth of impermanence and in understanding the practice and the Dharma. Whether it's been sitting with and meditating with someone who has a terminal diagnosis, or just exploring my own attitudes and beliefs and emotions about death, these have really connected me to the truth of beginnings and endings. And it was also death, in this case, the very sudden death of my partner, Bill, which helped me deal with and confront something that I had been not really willing to confront. I had been practicing kind of more on the surface, especially when it came to dukkha and painful experiences. And even though we're not really talking about dukkha today, I'm going to just spend a few minutes talking about how my relationship to it changed. So for many years, I had lots of strategies for not really dealing with the pain of things changing, not going my way, life being unsatisfactory, all the things that the way we define dukkha. Something painful would happen and I'd first think, oh, well, my life is so much better than so many others. You know, I don't need to like whine or get into what's going on. I practice a lot of gratitude and really these were ways that I kind of skipped over. But grief can be a gift and it has a way of kind of running the show. And when Bill, who was kind of like the ever-ready battery, he was super strong, could work 12, 14 hours a day, ran his whole life. He went for a run, had a rip in his aorta, and died within a minute. So when that all happened, it just like grief took over. And the pain of it threw all my strategies out the window. And if not for the first time, it was certainly consistently that I was willing to fully feel the first noble truth, the pain of dukkha. And I, of course, don't wish the loss of a loved one on anybody here. But for me, it was a doorway. And I encourage everybody to find their own doorways. We all have things that are going to be helpful to us. So I have a whole slew of practices. One of them is having a little mantra. So after Billy died, I was a wreck and I called one of my Dharma teachers and said, I've lost my refuge and I don't know what to do. And she gave me these words, which I have since repeated thousands of times, I think. And it's kind of like a mantra, although I've never practiced with mantras. But the phrase is, may I trust in the natural unfolding of life. And may I receive that unfolding with understanding and ease. That's been one of my practices when it seems like life is wrong. Like Steve was saying this morning, impermanence and not self are not problems, but our beliefs are often that they are a problem. And so I develop this practice of trusting in the natural unfolding of life. And once I fully immersed myself in, I don't think I had a choice, but I fully was immersed in the pain of this loss, a lot of my practice changed. It deepened. It's like when you learn about the first noble truth, and after you know about it, some teachers talk about three different insights, and the third insight about the first noble truth is to know that you know. And I knew, but it was kind of like above the eyebrows. And so then my knowing went deep, and then I knew what I knew. And I think that's the same thing with impermanence and anatta or anatta. That we know it intellectually, but we really need to know it in our gut. We need to dive deep. So anything can happen at any time. There is so much uncertainty. And the practice invites us to be with whatever arises out of life's circumstances, allowing us to feel the pain of uncertainty. Whatever doorway opens, you walk through it. In our death and dying group in Sims, we have the opportunity when members of our community are facing a terminal diagnosis, we create small support sanghas. And 6-7 years ago, I was part of a support sangha for this beautiful man. Spent his whole last year with him. And I remember when I first met him and I said to him, his name was Abdi. I said, Abdi, so you're letting these 6 strangers into your life for this last year of your life? And like, what's that all about? And he said, I don't know, but the door's opening and I'm just walking through it. Boy, have I taken that one with me a lot of times. So impermanence, anicca. Suzuki Roshi was once asked by a student, can you sum up all of Buddhism in one phrase? And he said, yep, everything changes. There's this American monk in the Thai forest tradition called Thanissaro Bhikkhu, and he says that the actual appropriate translation of anicca is not impermanent, but it's inconstant, because the A negates the nicca. Nicca means constant or dependable. So a more accurate translation, he says, is inconstant or not dependable. He says, if you're seeking a dependable basis for long-term happiness and ease, anything inconstant is obviously a stressful place to pin your hopes on. It's like trying to relax in an unstable chair whose legs are liable to break at any time, which is such a great image. Life can often feel like that, like we're trying to relax in a chair and we don't know when the legs are going to break. And for some of us here, this year, this pandemic has kind of made that even more front and present and difficult. The rules keep on changing, and we've been asked to live in ways we've never been asked to live before. So both translations, impermanent and inconstant, can be really helpful. So we all know this truth of life is changing all the time. That's the truth of things. But one of the things that happens, and this is in that effort to like know what we know, it's kind of digging a little deeper from the surface. So one of the things is that look at whether you have an exception list to that truth of impermanence. Yes, everything changes, but for those of us who are in committed relationships, but you won't die, at least not before me, or I won't die, at least for not a really long time. My job won't go away. I'm going to stay healthy. In my case, the hillside's not going to slide down on me, or I will feel this way forever. Whatever is in our exception list, make that conscious. Look at it. Maybe even get together with a friend and share your exception lists. It might be a pretty interesting conversation. A second thing that often happens is that we find that we have a habitual emotional response to uncertainty. And so before we even are really dealing with the certain circumstance of uncertainty, we're already in the emotion. For me, fear has been my go-to place. Certainly after Billy died, I kept on watching for like the second shoe to drop. But I've learned some things about not always trusting that fear is the appropriate response to uncertainty. I've learned to not push it away. Fear comes up and I go, oh, like, what do you have to teach me? I watch as it stays around. It doesn't always stay around. Not too long ago, I sat with Tim on our drop-in Tuesday morning sit, and my entire sit, I was anxious and fearful, and I just couldn't let it go. It just like kind of controlled the entire sit. Then the sit was over, and I went about my day, and then at 4 o'clock on Tuesdays, I have another sit. And the very first thing I noticed is that the fear was gone. It was like, what happened? You know, and did I make that fear come up? It just was causes and conditions. So looking at how you respond habitually to situations of uncertainty can be really helpful. For me, I've reminded myself that there have been lots of moments of scary times when I've done fine. And so I kind of remind myself that I have confidence, I have ability, I have agency around my life, and that I also know how to ask for help. So we each have certain abilities and qualities that help us deal with those habitual emotional responses. Another thing I do is I give myself little Dharma talks. Now, I don't know about you, but I've listened to hundreds of Dharma talks, and many of you have done that too. So you kind of know the way to do it. And so I give myself these little Dharma talks. It's kind of like I sometimes imagine the voice of our founding teacher, Rodney, and how he sometimes would point his finger at us. And I go, oh, wait a second, Suze, everything changes. Oh, right. That's what's happening right now. And it's going to change again. So I'm not about to get rid of my habitual emotional response, but I can let it hang out. I can learn from it. And I also know that I'm not going to put it in charge. Some of you who are my friends here have heard me say this before, but I say to fear, okay, fear, you can come along. You're in my pocket, but I'm not giving you my car keys. So I'm going to use other parts of me to make those decisions. So do you have habitual responses to the truth of impermanence when difficult things happen? How do you respond? With argument? With anger? Do you seek out all distractions that are available? Are you somehow surprised? How are you dealing with an aging body and mind? In our small group, aging was brought up this morning, and a Dharma friend who's like 10 or 15 years younger than me said to me recently, I'm having trouble with this whole aging thing. And so what kind of trouble are you having? It's, you know, it's an opportunity for investigation. These changes are all natural. It's the natural unfolding of life. They're not mistakes. They're not a problem which needs to be fixed. We can investigate. And along with the little Dharma talks, I actually am very fond of chants. And there's this wonderful impermanence chant that if you ever have sat with Heather Martin, she loves doing it. I sometimes chant it in Pali, but I mostly chant it in English. All things arise and pass away. Understanding this deeply brings the great happiness, which is peace. Or sometimes it's translated as all things arise and pass away. To be at peace with this truth brings great happiness. And then around this self, this I who we think is calling all the shots and guiding life. As Steve pointed out this morning, it's a construct, it's an illusion. All our strong opinions and planning and strategizing, and of course, we need that, and thank goodness we've got the minds that can do that. One of our guiding teachers, Tim Guile, says he calls this the navigational self, or what Steve was talking about earlier of the conditional reality, the navigational self. But in the full picture, there is no continuous, solid, substantial self. It's an illusion. Ajahn Sumedho puts it this way. He says, anatta puts the personality into perspective. So we're not limited by the personality we created. It's seeing that the self we cling to is our own creation. We created ourselves. Desire is like this. It's not mine. The body is like this. It's not mine. It's not personal. And Joseph Goldstein, I love this quote. He quotes one of his teachers, Manindraji, as saying, it's not that the self isn't real. It's just that it's not really real. So here are some of my practices around anatta. The first is really noticing my strong desire to get my own way. and how the self gets really big because my way is the right way. And I don't know if anybody else identifies with that. So recently I had a little work party in my garden, and there are two guys who live behind me, and we were doing some stuff, and this one guy, and we, you know, I'm the gardener and they benefit from it. So I was kind of in charge, and I said, well, here's where we want to go. And the guy just started, this one guy started doing things in totally the wrong way. And I zipped up the mouth for a minute, and I thought to myself, what's most important here? Which was really that we had a good time and that we get some stuff done, but that we get along really well. So I didn't say anything. And in the end, everything was finished and we all had a pretty good time. Now, I know it's a small example, but there are so many times in our lives when getting our own way, that this self is the one that knows things. It can be really helpful to kind of have just another experience of shrinking that sense of self. Another is what I call getting over myself. So recently I had the opportunity to work with somebody new on a project, and our first interactions were via email, and they were just awful. This person who was supposed to, she and I, or we were supposed to be doing this together, and this person kept on asking questions that just seemed kind of dopey. And so instead of just continuing that way, we decided to do a Zoom call. We got to meet each other, got to know each other a little bit. And I realized that this person was given this project by people who hadn't given her full information. And so I kind of got over the fact that you should be able to have known this, and let's move ahead, and this is the way we do things. We got to know each other. We worked things out. And in the end, it was to both of our satisfactions. And while both of these are really small example, we can see how so tightly holding on to our opinions and beliefs about how things should be can really get in the way, and they can reinforce the sense of self. Letting go of labels. We all have added labels to ourselves. A teacher at Spirit Rock, Eugene Cash, talks about this wonderful exercise he used to do with his young daughter, where they would sit across from each other and she would say, "You are not my father." And he would say, "You are not my daughter." And they would do this for 5 or 10 minutes as a way, not to deny the fact of father and daughter, but to open themselves up to the various selves that were in the room. And while you may not get to the agreement of somebody else to do that with, it can be a really important kind of exercise to do. I am not the teacher. You are not the student. I am not the spouse. You can fill in the blank. For years, I lived in a junkyard. Well, I still live there, but the junkyard's gone. I was known as the junk lady on Westlake Avenue. But then after Billy died, I got rid of 200 tons of junk. And so everything's all cleaned up. So what happened to the junk lady? Or, you know, for years people knew me, oh, that's Sue's, that's Billy's sweetie. Well, Bill's gone, so I'm nobody's sweetie now. I used to see kayak, and then I stopped sleeping on the ground. And so what happened to the Sue's who was a sea kayaker? So we all have those labels that we've added to ourselves. And letting go of them can be really helpful. Language, especially in practice, and that it can be so helpful to use the passive voice. So often we'll say, oh, I'm a really fearful person, or I've got whatever the diagnosis is that you decided you have. I've got this diagnosis or that diagnosis. What if instead we say, fear is present. Anxiety just showed up. Anger is here. And remember, I don't know if you remember, but I used these words in the first sit of the day. let all that belong to the moment. They don't have to belong to you. They belong in the moment, the passive voice of what's present right now. Allowing all that arises to continue to be present. You're not dismissing it. You're not pushing it away or latching onto it. But you don't have to identify with it. And earlier, someone asked about how does all this have to do with relationships? I have this one example, and what I want to share is that I have a really good friend who's going through very, very difficult times. And the truth is that she's pushed me out. And I'm pretty sure that I didn't do anything that caused it. I've come to understand that she's doing what she's doing. That friendships arise and pass just like everything else in our lives. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. Some friendships even have a shelf life. I mean, I don't know how that happens, but there are people who I used to see every single day who I haven't talked to in 10 years. So I wouldn't encourage you to start with the most difficult relationships in your life, but try to see if there's a relationship that you can look at with this a little bit less of that stickiness. In our small group this morning, we talked a lot about stickiness and feeling entangled. One person shared bringing some goodwill and compassion. It might help you see, oh, I'm going through all this up and down and turmoil. Maybe you are too. So there are a lot of those practices, and I'm just going to go over them. So first, you know, really see for yourself, know what you know, go deep. Don't hang out on the surface of these teachings. Really allow yourself to experience them. See if you have an exception list to impermanence. Look at the habitual responses, sometimes those emotional responses. Give yourself a Dharma talk. Listen to Dharma talks. Study. Read the suttas. Really investigate. Do you have trouble with the truth of the way things are? Watch the emotions come and go. Letting go of some of the labels. Try to get over yourself. Getting your own way, being in control. Try using the passive voice. Test out some of these things in friendships. And the most important, I think, the topic of our day was finding freedom through impermanence and not self. Well, how do you find that freedom? And I think it's by noticing the moments of non-selfing. Notice the moments when you feel the resistance with someone disagreeing with you or that you've got to be in charge or whatever. But instead, you kind of loosen the grip and you open to the moment. When you've kind of argued with this moment and then you just stop and you go, oh, right. Things arise and pass away. This isn't a problem. This is just the truth of things. When you might let go of a label or not add a new one of identification. Those moments when you realize that life is unfolding just as it is. Don't pass over those moments too quickly. These are those doorways that Steve and I have been talking about. I love when Joseph Goldstein talks about freedom as being small moments many times. And that's what we're doing in our practice. Those little moments when you thought, oh my God, I am such a mess. And then some insight comes up and you go, wait a second, I'm not a mess. Life is really difficult. I'm navigating, you know, whatever your little talking to yourself is, those moments of being able to see through the fog, the habits, the delusions, the clinging, the pushing away, when you see through those and you go, all right, a moment of being with. Celebrate those. I think those are our moments of freedom. And look at that. Not too bad, 29 minutes. Thank you for your attention.